Over on the other side of the world, another former enemy nation has likewise come back with vigor and determination. I mentioned it, the people of Japan. Conscientious, hardworking, able, alert people have been responding to the challenge that is theirs. The communists would like to see Japan remain a military vacuum, just as they'd like to see West Germany remain a military vacuum. Meanwhile, free men all over the world are coming to a rebirth. There is a ferment, as I said, throughout the vast arc of free Asia. Undeveloped peoples are coming into their own. People are rising from age-old conditions of poverty, malnutrition, disease. The progress may be slow, but everywhere there is ferment in the East. A search is for sound ideas, and thank God they are finding them. To be sure, the communist firebrands are seeking to ignite more flames of nationalism and racialism against us. But free Asia is not being fooled, as was indicated by Ramelow's report of what took place at Bandung. The Philippines, Pakistan, Ceylon, Burma, Indonesia. Friends of ours spoke out in the face of that great threat. While I'm here in this area, I say that in spite of our often wide differences with distinguished leaders like India's Prime Minister Nehru, there's every good reason to work with him for peace on the continued basis of sincere, cordial, deep respect. He's a great leader of a great people, an eloquent, earnest, dedicated leader. I have no time for ill-tempered Americans who go off half-beam or half-cocked, completely exasperated because of our differences with Nehru. Just as I hope thinking Indians will have no time for Indians to exaggerate and aggravate our differences. Let us remember the rule of Lincoln, which was, before you pass judgment, put yourself in the other fellow's shoes. In other words, get where he's standing and see the facts of life as they exist there. Let us note that on a great many occasions, Nehru has been outstandingly effective in serving the cause of freedom throughout the world. The peoples of the underdeveloped areas are, as I've indicated, coming into their own. Our hand of friendship remains gladly extended to them, to all of them, I add. They want to hear from us a positive, constructive, imaginative program. We must not simply wait for crisis to develop. The Soviet challenges the free world, say in place A. The free world then responds. The Soviets challenge us in place B. We respond. It is the Reds who have been picking the time and the place. Yet we know that it is poor strategy for us always to allow the enemy to choose the field and time of contact. Moreover, it is definitely not enough for us to offer anti-communism alone a program to the world. It is up to us to get across the danger of communism in all its savage barbarism. Other peoples of the world, particularly undeveloped peoples, are not going to respond to a negative program. They want affirmative hope. They want specific and constructive suggestions, but neither should we keep accentuating the negative. Now, my friends, I would not want to leave this occasion with a narrow concept of the fundamental idea of freedom itself. Freedom is simply not a matter alone of formal conditions of freedom, which we have known as freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, assembly, employment, property. Great as these blessings are, freedom is basically a spiritual thing. There have been great men and women who have been slaves in the sense they have been chattels of others, and yet they have been free. Why? Because their minds have been free. Their spirits have been free. You cannot shackle the mind of a man who is free as you can the human flesh. There have been people who are free and who are slaves in the sense that they have sold their spiritual birthright for a mess of pottage. I've known people like that in this United States. On the other hand, there are men and women living in abject poverty today who are free and who enjoy riches that the wealthiest man, enslaved by the lust for power or money, does not know. The poor man who is free in spirit can scale the heights which the man enslaved by greed can never mount. Nobility of mind makes men free. Clearness of vision to what is real, what is lasting, that is truly good. Yes, the things of the spirit. What matter if Abraham Lincoln never accumulated a great deal of wealth? What matter if he never completely arose from poverty but constantly lived with meager resources? He, in the large sense, was a free man. He was a man whose spirit could not be downed. Why? Because he drew upon the eternal spirit, the all-knowing, the all-present, all-seeing creator, when difficulties mounted for him. A poet has said, he is the free man who the truth makes free, and all are slaves besides. He is the free man whom truth makes free, and all are slaves besides. The people behind the Iron Curtain may be chained in bondage, but we know that even the cruelest master of the Arctic forced labor camps cannot quench the fire of freedom which burns freely in the breasts of some of these people. Abraham Lincoln had said, I believe that this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. He was right. Human beings are not property to be bought and sold, and no society should endure on that basis. So today we answer the basic question for us by saying, may all this world one day be free? To that end, we pledge our best efforts in peace and in justice. And two, we reject all despair that the Soviet Empire will last indefinitely. Rather, we believe that empire is subject to terrific internal stresses and strains. We know something about that. They've had failures in crops. The people in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, the Baltic states, now for a matter of 10 years practically, have been promised the millennium. But it hasn't come. And when men make promises like that to you and me, we don't wait that long. They don't fulfill them, we know what to do. Consequently, in these countries, there is underground resistance and overground resistance. And may these eternal stresses and strains, which one day may it render asunder from within and thus permit the subject peoples to regain their freedom. For the freedom that makes free is abroad. The freedom that makes free is abroad in the world, even in Russia, my good friends. It's been a great joy to be here with you today. I have really gotten a pickup seeing folks dressed as they dressed in Lincoln's day, going into the room where he and Douglas sat. Yes, seeing the chair, the old furniture, and feeling that perhaps here Lincoln was today telling us. What would he tell us? I think he would say, my fellow Americans, it's for us to be adequate. As we were adequate. It's for you to be alerted to the facts of life as they exist today. Don't dream about the past. Sense that this is a new world in which you live. This world has been foreshortened by the ingenuity of man, so much so that an aeroplane recently flew from Los Angeles to New York in 3 hours and 45 minutes. And I was told today that they are working on another plane that in another year will make it 2 hours and 45 minutes. From Los Angeles to New York. And a plane went from Newfoundland to Southern Ireland in 3 hours and 25 minutes. And my own state of Wisconsin and your own state of Illinois is more subject to attack today than New York City. Over the Circle Route, you're only a matter between 5 and 6 hours. The bombers from Siberia. That's part of the facts of life that you and I must become acquainted with. Since then, since I went to Washington, the A-bomb and the H-bomb has come into being. The A-bomb in Hiroshima took 70,000 lives. The H-bomb, and it's not the largest, can take 10 times that many. That's a fact of life we better get acquainted with. Here in this area, the government of the United States is establishing Nike sites up around Chicago and Milwaukee, sensing that over the Circle Route, if war should come, that this area, as I said, is more amenable to attack than many areas that we thought only could be attacked when I went to Washington. There are other facts we must bear in mind. We must bear in mind the economic facts, because there are a lot of grumblers that don't sense the great potentialities of this country. My friends, when I went to Washington, we had an income, a national income of $70 billion. Today, our income goes up to $275 billion, and we're marching toward $300 billion. When I went to Washington 16 years ago, we had a national product of only $90 billion. Today, our national product is $370-odd billion. So you see, when we spend $32 billion for defense, you've got to recognize that we're not spending the proportion that some people talk about. And you recognize that we have been chosen, which we weren't 16 years ago, as a leader among the nations of earth. Just as Lincoln gave leadership, so must we. And we must get what is called adequacy. Cut out the fearsomeness, the doubting, and recognize that here in this God's country, there's a great treasure house that we must preserve. We've been chosen to look after it. And Lincoln would have us be adequate as he was. When others said no, he said, carry on. Yes, it's been a great joy to be with you today. And I sincerely hope that this forum series will produce the type of food, will produce ideas, vital, energizing ideas. Food for the mental stimulation and progress, and for the national and international progress and stimulus, which the fruits of the great Lincoln-Douglas debates of a century ago produced. Now, I said I would be very happy to seek to answer any of your questions, so I thank you for your attention.
I asked some questions that were given to me before. Senator Wiley, do you think there is any possibility of a rebellion in Soviet Russia?
I have nothing definite more than what I've said. You know, a police state has everything in its favor. Right in this town here, if you had 25 men with machine guns, you'd obey their orders. Because especially if you didn't have weapons of your own, and in a state like Russia, they see to it that people don't have weapons. The general consensus is that there's no possibility at present of any, what you call, breaking out that could be effective. I think that's the judgment of our intelligence.
Do you think President Eisenhower will run again in 1956?
My answer to that is, I think he will. I don't know myself from talking with him, but I feel that if conditions do not improve, that he will feel that the mandate from the people is necessary. Every place I've gone, I've found that Ike is way up here with the people. They have faith in him. They realize he's a man of tremendous integrity and honesty, and that's the first requisite of a public servant. Strange thing, but that man really has the confidence of the American people, because he is in so many ways just natural and humble.
Newspapers speculate that Senator Nolan may want the vice presidency in 1956. In view of his disagreements with Eisenhower on foreign policy, do you think they could be running mates on the 1956 ticket?
Well, I'm not in a position to judge the future. In my opinion, I feel that it's necessary that in a president and vice president, there be absolute teamwork. I agree that's imperatively necessary. However, there have been occasions when, for instance, there have been rebellious groups in the party that have named vice presidents that probably were not just 100% with the president. That the candidate, but I don't think that's the situation now. I think the people of the United States are going to determine that Ike is going to run, and he's going to have the running mate that he wants.